From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as we await the election results, we look at the electoral process. We discuss the pros and cons of the Electoral College system with Curtis Gans, director of the Committee for the Study of the American Electorate, and Akhil Amar, who teaches constitutional law at Yale Law School. This year, more voters than ever have taken the option of voting earlier, voting by mail. The voting process may be under transformation. We'll take a look at non-traditional voting with Rob Ritchie, Executive Director of the Center for Voting and Democracy. Voting on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Polls in a number of states have closed, and NPR is projecting that George W. Bush has won six states. NPR's Barbara Bradley is in the studio with us now. Barbara, what six states are we looking at? Any surprises here?
Well, there aren't really any surprises. The six states are Indiana, Kentucky, Georgia, South Carolina, Vermont, and Virginia. And these were solidly Republican, so really there is not a surprise here.
Now, one of the states that just closed or partially closed is Florida, a big battleground state. What do we know about that?
It's really too early to know that right now, both for the presidential and the Senate race. We do know, well, according to the Voter News Service projections, the Democrat candidate for Senate, Bill Nelson, who's a former congressman and the state immigration commissioner, is leading in his race against Republican candidate Bill McCollum and also independent Willie Logan. Now, according to exit polls, what's helping Nelson are voters who cared a lot about the environment and independent voters. And it also, parenthetically, looks like Bill Nelson is doing better in Florida than Vice President Al Gore. But as I said, it's too close to call right now. Bill McCollum is well known in the state and nationally for his past role as a House manager. You'll remember that in early 1999, a dozen House Republicans served as prosecutors during the Senate impeachment trial of President Clinton. And some believe that this seems to be an anti-impeachment vote.
Thank you, Barbara. We'll be watching. Florida could be an early indicator of how tight the presidential race will be and how it'll turn out. From Tallahassee, NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
Florida voters appear energized by the high stakes here. There's a sense that their vote will indeed make a difference in the tight presidential race. Supporters stood on street corners in Tallahassee this afternoon, waving signs for their candidate and urging drivers to honk in support. Lines were long at polling places throughout the state. 25 electoral votes are at stake in what both candidates have called a critical battleground state. Earlier today, Florida Governor Jeb Bush made a last-minute push for Republicans to get out the vote for his brother, Texas Governor George W. Bush. He worked a phone bank in Tallahassee, calling to remind people to vote and assuring seniors that his brother would not hurt Social Security. Before dawn today, Vice President Al Gore visited with nurses at a Tampa hospital before going back to Tennessee. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Tallahassee.
With the election as close as it is, the presidential campaigns are working hard to turn out their voters. The Gore campaign and the Democratic National Committee say they've mustered 50,000 volunteers to reach out to voters with telephone calls and email. Some polling places reported long lines of voters waiting patiently to cast their ballots. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 25 points to close at 10,952. This is NPR News. Another race that's expected to be very close is the fight for the U.S. Senate seat from New York. First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton and Republican Congressman Rick Lazio are expected to wait well into the night before their race is decided. Lazio told supporters today that the race is tied in the bottom of the ninth, but he identified himself as the home team and said the home team is up. Mrs. Clinton said she'd just wait and see what happens. African-American voters who are having trouble getting to the polls today are getting a little assistance from funeral homes. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports from Chicago.
It's really not so odd. Chicago's infamous reputation of gathering votes from the graveyard grew 40 years ago during another close presidential race. This election, African-American turnout is considered key, so groups like the National Funeral Directors and Morticians Association have joined the turnout effort. David Boone, the director of Unity Funeral Parlor in Chicago, says he and other funeral homes are using their limousines to help people get to the polls.
I'd like to be known that this is a national effort on the part of the mortician, the black mortician. It's being done all across the country, and I'm spearheading the effort here in Illinois.
Boone says more than 20 funeral home limos began providing rides to Chicagoans and suburbanites early this morning, and the service will be available to voters until the polls close. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
The Missouri Senate race pits Republican incumbent John Ashcroft against the late Governor Mel Carnahan, who was killed in a plane crash. Carnahan's widow, Jean, has said that she'd accept an appointment to the Senate seat if her husband is the winner. Although all 435 House seats are up for election, roughly 50 of those are considered to be really competitive. Voters across the country will also be deciding statewide ballot measures. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The presidential race appears to be very close, and it's conceivable that the next president will have won the vote in the Electoral College without having won the popular vote. And this possibility has many people wondering if it's time to abolish the Electoral College system. My guest Akhil Amar says we should abolish it. Amar teaches constitutional law at Yale Law School. My other guest, Curtis Gans, says keep the Electoral College, but reform it. Gans is the founding director of the Committee for the Study of the American Electorate. The Electoral College was written into the Constitution in 1787. When you vote for president, you're actually voting for the elector pledged to that candidate. Each state has the same number of electors as its combined number of U.S. senators and representatives. There are 100 senators and 435 representatives in Congress, and the District of Columbia has 3 electors in the college, bringing the total to 538. With the exception of Maine and Nebraska, in each state, the presidential candidate who has won the majority of votes wins the state's total number of electoral votes. This winner-take-all approach is what makes the battleground states so important. I asked Gans and Amar how they think the Electoral College system has affected the campaign. Here's Gans.
This election illustrates both the strengths and the weaknesses of the Electoral College. The weaknesses are obvious. We may have an election in which we have a winner in a popular vote and a different winner in the Electoral College vote. The second weakness is also obvious, which is all the resources, or almost all the resources, of this campaign are being concentrated on about 17 states, with each candidate giving up the other states as winner, some of them for the opposition and some of them for himself. The strengths are also illustrated in this election, which is to say, in those battleground states, the competition is really fierce. The candidates have to speak to the disparate groups in those states, have to take into account their views, have to build winning coalitions, have to organize on the grassroots amongst these various and disparate groups to maximize their vote. And in those states, you have democracy and pluralism working as it should. But we do have 33 states in the District of Columbia that have essentially been abandoned by these campaigns.
Akhil Amar, do you agree with that?
Yeah, it's a pretty strong indictment of the system when basically two-thirds of the states are taken for granted, and voters in those states might not feel a particularly strong imperative to go out to vote. The governments in those states might not have a particularly strong incentive to encourage their voters to turn out. And if you had direct popular election, the system that I favor, which is basically how we pick governors across the country. It's not an odd system at all. It's how we pick senators across the country within each state. If you had a system of direct national popular election, every state government actually would have a strong incentive to get its citizenry out to vote. The more folks, let's say, from Massachusetts go out and vote, then the more Massachusetts is counting in a larger national election. And what's true for Massachusetts is true for New York and California and Arkansas and every other state. And so you'd have, I think, better incentives for our governments to make it easier for us to vote and to get us out to vote.
Well, before we get deeper into the debate about the Electoral College, another question about how the electoral vote is affecting this year's campaign. Let's look at the Ralph Nader campaign. Do you think that a third-party campaign like that has any more or less of an effect with the Electoral College? For example, say that there's a swing state, and the say Nader gets 5%, and that siphoned votes from Al Gore in that state, and therefore the state gives all of its electoral votes to George Bush. Would that mean that Nader's having a disproportionate effect in the electoral system than he would in the popular vote?
I think that the biggest difference for third-party candidates is the following. If you have direct popular election, if you amend the Constitution, you're going to have to try to think about the following question. Is it going to be enough for someone to get a plurality of the national popular vote, or do they need an absolute majority? If they need an absolute majority, you're going to basically have to ask, are you going to have a runoff election, or are you going to have instant runoffs? An instant runoff system is one in which, let's say, some people vote for Nader. Let's say 48% vote for Bush and 47% vote for Gore, and the rest go to Nader. Now, neither Bush nor Gore in that situation would have 50% of the popular vote. And so an instant runoff system would basically say, okay, all you Nader voters, your man came in third, so he lost. Now, do you have a second choice? Is it Bush? Is it Gore? Or is it none of the above? And in effect, we reallocate your ballots to that second choice immediately, and then someone has a majority of the remaining votes, and that's how a system would work. So if you were to move to direct popular election, you might move to a kind of instant runoff system that would have some implications for third-party candidates.
So if I was voting in that kind of instant runoff system, would I be able to vote my second choice in that one ballot?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. You would say, well, Nader is really the guy I like the most, and then and your vote would be counted for Nader in the first round. But when it became clear that lots of fellow citizens basically disagreed with you, their genuine first choice was either Bush or Gore, you would basically be given now the option. You could express a preference for Bush or Gore, or in effect you could say, I have no preference between those two. I sit out, in effect, the runoff election. And so we would have on your ballot, we would give you an option of listing a second choice or giving the option to say, of the remaining two, I have no preference.
Chris Gans, what do you think of that?
I think you got a problem, you know, which is only one of a series of problems with direct elections. But I assume that if you wrote the law, that the Bush voters would also have to give a second choice, and the Gore voters would also have to give a second choice, you know, along with the Nader and Buchanan, you know, Hagelin and whoever was running. But suppose, you know, as is the case, a lot of Gore voters find Bush totally anathema. And so instead of, you know, saying no preference, they say Nader, which is indeed, you know, a lot of them would do. And you would be in a situation in which you would not have a majority. And there are, you know, surely people on the right supporting Bush who find Gore anathema. And they may make a second preference of Buchanan.
Yeah, but that doesn't. But that, none of that is relevant if the two top vote getters, regardless of whether they have an initial majority, are Bush and Gore. You never get to their second choices. The only people whose second choices count, or third for that matter, are those who are voting for the fringe candidates. That's just.
You're just.
With all due respect, I think you're not following the system.
Well, you know, all I'm trying to say is, you know, that. It will be hard to design a system that, you know, that is fully acceptable, you know, to the public of the United States, if not, you know, if only certain candidates put forward their second choice.
It seems to me you're not going to both agree on this issue today, so let's get to another subject that you're not going to agree on today, which is the future of the Electoral College. Curtis Ganz, you support the continuation of the Electoral College. Akhil Amar, you think we should just have a popular vote for the presidency. Curtis Ganz, why do you support the continuation of the Electoral College, knowing full well that even in this election, the popular vote might not be the same as the electoral vote?
Well, I support it, and it should be said also with potential modifications, in preference to direct elections. And I support it, you know, because I think historically we wanted the Electoral College because it was an expression of our federalism and our pluralism, and that it forced competition for, you know, both interests and states and regions and grassroots campaigning. I think that's still valid, which is to say, if we move to a direct popular election, essentially in this climate, in this politics, what we would be moving to is a national media campaign. There would be no incentive to go to any particular state and do any particular grassroots organizing. What you would have is a TV and tarmac campaign.
Well, why? Why does that follow? That
because that's, you know, where we have moved, you know, in the various statewide elections, you know, that Akhil talks about. You know, for instance, the average senatorial budget in a competitive campaign right now spends 60% on media, 30% on fundraising, 10% on candidate travel and staff, and nothing for grassroots activity. That's where, you know, that's what our politics has become, and that's what it will become in presidential campaigns. The second and more minor reason is that, by and large, our presidential campaigns get decided on a national level in terms of the popular vote by millions of votes. Increasingly, people do not find their vote makes any difference. But in state contests, those get decided by thousands of votes, and in a few cases, hundreds of votes, and people can see their vote makes a difference. So that I think the incentive provided by the grassroots, by pushing campaigns to the grassroots, pushing campaigns into states, taking into account interests that will be part of a governing coalition, is more important for a governing president than the one-man, one-vote principle. But I do think we can do better, and we can discuss that after Akhil has his say on direct elections.
Well, not so quick. First, we have to take a break. Then we'll talk more about the Electoral College with Akhil Amar and Curtis Ganz. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the Electoral College system. Akhil Amar thinks we should abolish it. He teaches constitutional law at Yale Law School. Curtis Ganz thinks we should keep the system but reform it. Ganz directs the Committee for the Study of the American Electorate. Akhil Amar, tell us why you would like to do away with the Electoral College and keep the presidency based on a popular vote.
A few reasons. First, the Electoral College system in its origins is tainted. It's in important respects a product of racism and sexism. Racism first. The basic advantage for many people 200 years ago of an electoral college system instead of direct national election was that it gave the South, the slaveholding South, a leg up. If you had direct national election, there would be many more northern voters than southern voters, but the Electoral College enabled the southern states to count their entire populations, including their slaves. Now, their slaves were discounted, but basically it made states like Virginia the California of the founding, because even though Virginia didn't let very many people vote, it got a lot of electoral votes in the system because it could count its slaveholding population as part of its Electoral College base. Of the first 36 years of the presidency, a slaveholding Virginian is president for the first for 32 of those first 36 years. Washington for 8 years, Jefferson for 8, Madison for 8, Monroe for 8. That's the racism part of it. It's connected to a system that really propped up slavery. The sexism part is also easy to see. If you had direct national election and you enfranchised your women, for example, then your state would actually get a lot more clout in the overall system. So direct national election was actually more democratic 200 years ago, and it would have given incentives to expand the franchise. And so the system that we have inherited is actually a residue of certain things that we don't believe in anymore, like racism and sexism. Now, if it's going to be defended today, there are some possible arguments, but I don't buy them. One argument is somehow that it encourages candidates to go to all sorts of different regions, but so would direct national election, because that's where the votes are. We don't pick our governors by an electoral college system within the state, and the suggestion is, well, then we get these tarmac campaigns. That's what we have for the national presidency, too, whether we like it or not, whether we have direct national election or the Electoral College, we're pretty much going to see the same basic national media campaigns. And the reason we are is that, in general, the person who wins the electoral vote also wins the popular vote, and vice versa. So you won't see dramatic changes, I think, in the style of campaigning, because, in general, what it takes to win one also wins you the other.
Curtis Gans, I'd like you to respond to Akhil Amar's comments that the Electoral College is based on racism and sexism, and it would, you know, make sense to take that out of the system now by reforming the Electoral College, by getting rid of it.
Two things. I don't think, you know, that the Electoral College historically came out of either of those motivations. The Electoral College came out of the fact, as my colleague Gary Wills, has written eloquently, that the Founding Fathers wanted Congress to be the prime entity in government, the legislative body, and that's why, for instance, House members are directly elected. They wanted the president to be basically an administrative officer. They wanted to create a balance between a national government and a federal government, devolving powers to the states. They wanted to create a balance between the big states and the small states, which is why the electors are essentially chosen by a hybrid, which represents both the senators, which are states equal regardless of population, and the representatives, which are states represented by their population. I mean, it was a complex set of factors, and they also didn't particularly want, at that time, the president to have a popular mandate, because they saw Congress as being preeminent. I don't know whether any of that's relevant to the current discussion. The fact is that when you look at statewide contests that are now being conducted, they are being conducted by television, and those campaigns, by and large, have very little grassroots activity and have, in those states that rely on television most, like California and New York and others, have had amongst the largest declines in voter participation. It is indeed true that because of the present makeup of the Electoral College system, states are abandoned. But in the states that in which there are battlegrounds and fighting, you don't have only a television and tarmac campaigns. There's about $250 million of party money, to say nothing of interest group money, And by interest group, I mean things like the NAACP as well as the National Association of Manufacturers, which is being poured into grassroots activity to the type of thing that you do not have in statewide campaigns. What we will lose if we move to direct election is the involvement of people in our campaigns.
Curtis Gans, what you're calling, you know, grassroots campaigning, can't you make the argument that that's just more lobbying and more stuff that's as phony as the stuff that you see on television?
I don't think it's phony for, you know, for people to go to, you know, for the NAACP or Rainbow Push or Operation Big Vote to go door to door in the black community and recruit voters. I don't think it's phony for the Christian Coalition to mobilize its membership or for the environmentalists to express their concern, or both people on each side of the abortion issue. I don't think that's phony at all. I think those people can see how their ground troops, particularly as we move to a lower turnout election, can really make a difference in outcomes. And they only can see that, you know, in the context of smaller units. And indeed, the type of reform I would prefer is a reform that would bring it down to smaller units, and would not bring it down to the, would not open it up to a large national free-for-all that would be a media campaign.
I basically agree that there's a difference between grassroots campaigning and a television and a tarmac campaign. I simply disagree that direct national election would actually have less grassroots mobilization. I, in fact, think it would have more. So that's just a disagreement as a matter of fact. And I think one other thing, I agree that we want to get more people out. We want to invigorate people in the world's greatest democracy. One way to do that is to give state and local governments a strong incentive to encourage people to vote. The Electoral College has exactly the wrong incentives. A given state gets the same number of electoral votes in the current system, whether a lot of people turn out or very few people turn out. In a direct national election system, each state government would have a very strong incentive to get its citizenry out to make it easy for them to vote, because the more of them voted from that state, the bigger a role they would be playing in the national process. So direct national election would create encouragements for the kinds of legal reforms that would get people out to vote, which and Curtis Gans and I both agree that that's an important thing.
Akhila Marr teaches constitutional law at Yale Law School. Curtis Gans is the director of the Committee for the Study of the American Electorate. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated Bantam Books Division, publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, the story of the men who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, why non-traditional voting is catching on. We look at early voting and mail-in balloting with Rob Ritchie, Executive Director of the Center for Voting and Democracy. And we continue our discussion about the Electoral College system. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our discussion about the Electoral College system. My guest Akil Amar says that we should abolish the system. Amar teaches constitutional law at Yale Law School. Curtis Gans directs the Committee for the Study of the American Electorate. He says we should keep the system, but reform it. Curtis Gans, if you could reform the Electoral College, which is what you'd really like to do, how would you change it?
From my point of view, the most healthy reform that we could create is that every state should have the system that now exists in Nebraska and Maine. In Nebraska and Maine, if you win the popular vote in that state, you win the two electors that represent the two U.S. senators. But to get any or all of the other electors, you have to compete on a congressional district basis. What that would mean on one level is that if he competed on a congressional district basis, the Electoral College vote would more nearly reflect the popular vote. The more important thing is that it would not make candidates abandon states or regions. Al Gore, with the exception of Tennessee and Arkansas and Florida, has essentially abandoned the South, with good reason. Most of the Southern states are going to go Republican. On the other hand, one-third of the congressional delegation and a little more is Democratic. And that would provide an incentive in going congressional district by congressional district for Al Gore to compete in all those southern states for those districts that are Democratic and for those districts that are up for grabs. Similarly, George Bush has virtually abandoned New York, New Jersey, the Northeast, but there are a whole slew of districts there that are either competitive or Republican. What this would do is precisely the opposite of direct elections. It would force candidates to spend more time in all states and go after grassroots vote and organize the grassroots vote. Because whether Akil likes it or not, when you move to the larger units, the history is clear. We move to television campaigning and we abandon grassroots campaigning, and this revision of the system would move us much more to grassroots campaigning and political organization.
Akil Amar, what do you think? If we kept the Electoral College, would these reforms be an improvement?
It's a very interesting suggestion. Now, of course, to move to district rather than statewide electoral tallies, as a practical matter, we would need a constitutional amendment because states are not likely to do this on their own for the following reason. If California basically says, we're going to allocate our electoral votes by district, then rather than 54, count them, 54 big votes being in play, as a practical matter, maybe only 10 votes would be in play because one candidate would get maybe 35 and the other candidate maybe 20 or something like that. And so now California becomes not that much bigger than, say, New Jersey if New Jersey retains winner take all. So as a practical matter, each state with the exception of Nebraska and Maine, has opted for winner-take-all, and that's been true for most of American history, and there are reasons why a state would want to do that, to maximize its clout and influence. So if we're going to move on the district model as a practical matter, we would need a constitutional amendment because states are not going to do this individually. There's a collective action problem. Now, if we were to amend the Constitution that way, and as I said, it's an interesting proposal, what we are doing is we're endowing now the district lines with awesome significance. A lot of these districts are gerrymandered. They're gerrymandered in order to protect congressional incumbents. So whether these are actually the most sensible lines is a question. Some of them are designed to be very safe districts for incumbents, and so once again, actually district by district, there may not be as much contestation as Curtis would like.
Well, you both disagree on what we should do about the Electoral College. Let me bring up an issue that I suspect you agree on, which is that it's sad and depressing that there is such a comparatively low voter turnout. And Curtis Ganz, you say that there's been a pattern of declining voter turnout over the years. I'd be interested in hearing both of your opinions about why this is the case. Curtis Ganz?
Well, we've had a 25% decline in voter turnout nationally since the 1960s in both midterm and presidential elections, 30% outside the South. We've got 25 million people within our midst who used to vote who no longer do so. The United States stands 139th out of 163 democracies in the world. In last 2 years ago's midterm, first-time voters 18 to 19 voted at an 8% rate. We have serious problems for the underpinnings of American democracy. And most of that's been caused by large issues. I mean, we've had the erosion of trust that started with statements like, I am not going to send American boys to do what Asian boys are supposed to do, and continuing through, I did not have sexual relations with that woman. We've had declines in education, civic education, newspaper reading. We've had our political parties become weaker and more misaligned. We've had, as we saw in this election, network television abdicating its role for the full coverage of politics and public affairs. And we've had the way we conduct our campaigns and 30-second attack ads, which create a miasma over the political system and encourage people not to vote.
Akhil Amar, your thoughts about why voter turnout is so low?
I think Curtis spoke extremely eloquently, and I agree with virtually everything he said. I think that the observation about young adults not voting in large numbers is extremely acute and troubling. The work of Professor Putnam up at Harvard and others have really focused on that and many other declining indices of participation. To go back to the hobby horse of the Electoral College, just one second, I actually think in this election, because elderly Americans turn out to be swing voters in certain swing states, the candidates have focused disproportionate attention on their concerns and perhaps have left out of the conversation young adults who need to be brought into the thing. But let me say one other thing that just a brighter note. One reason that you might get some kinds of low turnout is because both candidates are relatively reasonable people in the middle. Because of improvements in polling and all the rest, some of the politicians have been able to move toward the middle. And many citizens say, well, it's not that big a difference between them. I could live with both. You get very high turnouts when you have one really extreme candidate on the ballot, a David Duke in Louisiana, for example. And so the slightly less grim story is that we're getting people who we will be able to live with. All of us will be able to live with, perhaps, or at least that might be one story that's a little bit less depressing.
One last question. What do you suspect you're going to find most invigorating and most depressing about the actual media coverage of the election after the polls close?
I want, very simply, the most depressing thing continues to be the networks telling people how they voted while they're still voting. In individual states like Indiana, where they'll project at 6 o'clock and Gary will still be voting, where they'll project in New Hampshire at 7 o'clock and Manchester will be still voting, and where they may project a national winner as early as 9 or 10, although it's unlikely in this close election, and that would depress turnout on the West Coast and perhaps interfere with the results of the election and perhaps the control of Congress. That practice has got to be stopped.
Akila Moore?
I want to go back to something that Curtis said earlier, with which I agree completely, that the media has defaulted its fundamental responsibility to help American citizens understand what's at stake. We've had an election in which most of the communication has been paid media, sound bites, short ads, often very negative, oversimplifying. The media has not done as good a job at giving candidates free time to expand at length upon their proposals. Even the debate format is one in which it's short sound bites rather than an extended conversation about, let's say, the 8 or 10 most important issues. If it's an important issue in the new millennium, it deserves more than 30 seconds. And yet, even the debate format, and there weren't nearly as many debates as there could have been and should have been, the debate format was 2 minutes on this, then 2 minutes on that, and then on to the other thing, as opposed to a general kind of Lincoln-Douglas-like conversation for grown-ups about the issues with more back and forth.
Well, I thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having
thank
us.
You.
Akila Moore teaches constitutional law at Yale Law School. Curtis Gans is the director of the Committee for the Study of the American Electorate. Coming up, why early voting and mail-in balloting are at an all-time high. This is Fresh Air. This year, more people than ever have voted without going to the polls on Election Day. 13 states now allow early voting. Residents can vote 17 to 21 days before Election Day. This year, for the first time, residents of Oregon could vote for president only through mail-in ballots. In some states, absentee ballots have been at an all-time high. We invited Rob Ritchie to talk with us about how the voting process is being transformed. He's the executive director of the Center for Voting and Democracy. I asked for his estimate of how much non-traditional voting there has been in this election.
Well, it really varies state to state. And you know, one of the oddities of the American system is that we let states determine how many of the electoral rules that govern the way we hold elections, access to the ballot, and the way we vote. And states just do it very differently. And so in some states, we'll have up to half the voters will be voting absentee or what's called early voting. In the entire state of Oregon, they will be voting by mail this year for the first time in a presidential race in which no one will go to the polls.
Why has Oregon done away with the voting booth for the presidential election?
It was an evolutionary process that came out of doing a lot of absentee voting. And by absentee voting, it's where you know people ask for a ballot so that they can vote by mail rather than have to be in person. And you know, started off with people who were seniors or had difficulty getting to the polls, and then it gradually expanded in some places to include those who thought they might have difficulty that day, to the point where some states now have it just no-fault absentee, and you can just ask for a absentee ballot just if for any reason you would prefer to vote that way. Well, Oregon was one of the forerunners in doing that, and once you start having a lot of people voting absentee, you are in a position where you, in a sense, have to conduct two parallel elections. You have to have all the apparatus to be able to do the polling place election and also to be able to do the absentee voting in a way that's fair and you make sure it's not corrupt and you know people aren't trying to vote twice and so on. And that part of it was just on the kind of administration side of things, that it's easier to just focus on one kind of election rather than both at the same time. It certainly is a lot cheaper. But there were a lot of good government reasons that proponents talked about as well, and the biggest one being voter turnout, that they believe that there's a higher voter turnout with vote by mail, and it equalizes the advantages of voting by mail, which previously might have gone more to people of higher incomes who sort of had the wherewithal and the knowledge to know to ask for an absentee ballot.
Is there any information yet about how it's affecting turnout?
It has a really big impact in races where turnout might not be high because people who otherwise vote don't make the time for it, like primary elections where we have extraordinarily low turnout in this country. Often, you know, barely 10% of registered voters vote in key primary races, and then in local elections that aren't in November, and we have a lot of elections in this country, you know, far more than other countries typically, and so people who might vote in a big presidential race just don't get around to voting in the local one, and vote by mail seems to really help with that kind of election. The evidence is far more mixed for big elections. It doesn't seem to have very much of an impact on those big elections that people do try to make the time for, though that's something we will definitely follow from this race in Oregon this year.
So in Oregon, what is the deadline to have your ballot in by mail?
You have to have your ballot in by today. So that if you're in Oregon and you don't want to go put it in the post office today because it has to be at the Board of Elections on the day of the election, that's not always the case. A lot of places that do absentee voting, you can postmark it by the day of the election, but in Oregon they want to be able to count the ballots and not have everyone say do it, you know, at the last minute. They've had a chance to vote for the last 3 weeks. And they also can drop it off. So people who, you know, don't want to put the cost of the stamp or they distrust the mail system, they can drop it off today, but they shouldn't mail it.
Now, 13 states are doing early voting now. How does that work?
Well, early voting, as its name suggests, means that you can vote early, and you can't vote at your regular polling place because they don't want to have all of the polling places open for that long a period of time. But you can go to a central place, typically the Board of Elections, and sit down and vote. And some places have been doing that since early October. In fact, we got, you know, concerned call from someone in California because people were already voting before the last of the presidential debates were done, which I don't think is so much of a problem, really. But some people are concerned that, you know, as the election season, the voting season actually gets spread out, that, you know, people are voting with differing information. But people have been voting for a while, and a lot of people do it. Some states, it's up to 30-40%. I think Nevada, the expectation is that nearly half of voters in Nevada will do early voting.
Now, there's also a lot of absentee ballots that are being filed this year. Why do you think that there's more this year than in previous presidential elections?
There is, and it's a combination of things. More states are relaxing absentee requirements so that more states can let you just ask for a ballot, or, you know, just making it easier to get one. And then because of that, you have the political parties and the campaigns more likely to try to get their core supporters to pursue that route, because that means it's just that many fewer people to worry about on election day. So that if you know that a quarter of the people that you want to be sure to vote for your candidate have already voted, then you just have that much less work to do on election day. So you're seeing more activity by the parties, you know, urging their supporters to do an absentee ballot, and then you have more people able to do it anyway, and you have people wanting to do it, which is one of the key things, I think, for all of these reforms, is that whether we are concerned or not about them, and I think there are some legitimate concerns about them, people seem to want to do them. And that, say, in Washington State, where they have very easy absentee requirements, and when you register to vote, you can express the option to be a permanent absentee voter, to say, well, I'm just always going to vote absentee. Most people select that option.
Hmm. What are some of the battleground states, the states that everybody's watching in the presidential election, that have early voting or a lot of absentee ballots or, you know, some kind of non-traditional focus on voting that might affect when the tallies come in?
Well, the West Coast or the western part of the U.S. generally seems to lead the way in this. And there's some dispute about, say, whether California is going to be a battleground or not, but there's certainly a lot of absentee voting and early voting there. You have the Oregon vote by mail situation where so people have been voting for president for weeks in Oregon, and you know maybe a good half the ballots have you know been cast before Election Day. And Washington State, in some ways, is the most intriguing one because so many people vote absentee there, and they don't have to vote until today, the day of the election, to put it in the mail. And it's considered one of the key battleground states, and it's, you know, there's 11 electoral votes that come out of Washington State, and if it's if the Electoral College count is as close as everyone's saying it could be, that could be decisive, and we won't have all the votes in until Thursday or Friday. And so we all might be waiting and learning a lot about absentee voting and about who votes absentee by comparing what the result is on election night in Washington and what it is on Thursday or Friday.
I don't know. Don't the voters in Washington feel like their vote is going to be an afterthought? I mean, so if it isn't a close race in the Electoral College, then Washington isn't going to be in the tally on election night.
Well, that's the classic problem for all the West Coast states when we do all this, you know, quick exit polls and the quick reporting on what happens with the poll closings. You know, some states' polls close so early. You know, you have Indiana and Kentucky closing at 6 p.m. Eastern time. If you're in California, that's only 3 p.m., and if you're in Hawaii, that's only 1 p.m., and people will start reporting on who is winning those states that early. This year, I think it's close enough that all that early reporting won't tell us for sure who has won or lost, but that it still often sends a message that it's already over by the time that it's coming your way. And it definitely has an impact on turnout out there. It has an impact also on whether people are going to feel freer to vote for minor party candidates, say, or just kind of do something different with their vote because they won't have to worry quite as much about whether their vote is decisive. But that's obviously not a worry or rather it would be nicer if people didn't feel that their vote didn't count.
My guest is Rob Ritchie, Executive Director of the Center for Voting and Democracy. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Talking about the growing proportion of non-traditional voting, such as early voting, which is now an option in 13 states, and mail-in balloting. My guest is Rob Ritchie, Executive Director of the Center for Voting and Democracy. What are some of the arguments for or against non-traditional voting that you haven't mentioned yet?
Well, I think the concerns against it are often founded on the notion that they're gimmicks, that they really don't address the core problem, which is that people feel less associated with political parties or constituency organizations where this somewhat irrational act of voting. I mean, we always know, I mean, it's a very good thing to do, and we urge people to do it, but most of us know that, well, my one vote is probably not going to decide the race, but if I feel, you know, closely associated with other people who I know are voting similarly to me, then together it's like a collective action, and then it's all very important. And I think there's less feeling of that, particularly among young people, and then there's a perception that some people have that, well, it can all be fixed if we just go to some of these changes, and I think that's definitely not true. But the answer really to that really is more that we need to figure out a way to create that sense of community under the new rules, which I think inevitably we will go to. And I think that will include, by the way, eventually internet voting. You know, it seems particularly among young people, we did a essay contest for young voters, or young people, since many of them don't vote, on why don't they vote. And internet voting was one of the big things that they mentioned. And I think that that's certainly a trend that we will likely see eventually move toward. but then we'll have to figure out ways to make people feel connected. And I think that's a big challenge for our political system generally.
If we head more in the direction of early voting, what impact might that have on campaigning?
Well, it stretches out the time that the candidates are out there getting votes, and that's something we really need to look at or to study closely, because it does mean that you can the person who can be up on television, say, with high-profile political ads, and the way you might do the last weekend before a polling place election, might have an edge because they can be right in front of the voters, you know, for weeks. But the flip side is that some of the way that that money has been most effectively spent has been some last-minute ad that might not hold up to scrutiny, but it's kind of quite effective for a couple days. But if you try to do that for 3 weeks, it can have a backlash. And there was an Oregon Senate race where they did the first big vote-by-mail election there a few years back, in which that seemingly was the case, that the candidate who spent more money sort of came out with some negative ads and some things early on in the vote-by-mail process, and then there was kind of a backlash against that, and there was more time to kind of scrutinize what that candidate was doing. So that I think it will evolve. There will be new strategies developed. One of the ones that I think will be also quite interesting is that you can more easily track who's voting and not voting and get them to vote because it happens over a longer period of time. So that in a polling place election, like, you know, your traditional election, a well-organized campaign has to go to the polls about halfway through the day and check the voter rolls and make sure their supporters have voted, and then they rush back and they have their people phoning their supporters and say, hey, you haven't voted yet, and you have to do it this evening. Well, now that stretches out for, you know, 3-4 weeks. And so that helps those who are well organized. It could help those who have more money as well. And that interplay of kind of whether good, solid grassroots organization or money has more of an impact will be, I think, something very important to track.
Now, you mentioned earlier that your group did a study about why so many young people don't vote. What did you find? What were some of the answers?
Well, the answer we found, you know, what was from the participants themselves. We had, you know, 9,000 essays or so on the question of why don't we vote. And, of course, it's a self-selective group of who takes the time to participate in that. But we had a really kind of interesting mix, you know, including some essays that were extremely well written about why they're completely frustrated with the political process and didn't expect to vote, and then a lot of people who were trying to come up with some good proposals. But the biggest reform or sort of change of the way we do politics that they called for was nearly two-thirds of the essays wished that the candidates would speak to issues of concern to them more and just spend more time with them, go to campuses more and do more with young people. Of course, the problem is that because their voter turnout is low, the candidates, in weighing what to do with their time, generally go to where the votes are, which is older people. And so that's why we're kind of in a vicious cycle that we need to get out of. But they also very strong interest in internet voting. More than half wished that we had internet voting. And then the other kind of set of issues that I thought was interesting is changes that would allow more third-party politics, interest in proportional representation, ballot access changes, having the debates have more than two candidates. And I think that speaks to the fact that young people have seen so many ads and so many people have tried to sell them things. You know, that's we're in this consumer culture in a way, and like politics in a sense, when some politicians are perceived as just trying to sell them things, and when you're trying to be all things to at least half the people, which is what by definition we have to be to win in under our current political rules, I think that the young people can feel that there's just a certain lack of sincerity, that they're just, you know, that they're just pretending to be what they say they are, and whether that's true or not, I think that can be a perception, and I think that raises some fundamental questions about whether under the current rules we'll be able to have the kind of politics that they want to have.
Well, Rob Ritchie, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure, it's been pleasurable, and I'm very curious to see what all those voters do today.
Rob Ritchie is the executive director of the Center for Voting and Democracy. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Megan Howell, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss the election results and the ups and downs of the Gore and Bush campaigns with Washington Post reporter Dana Milbank and satirist Harry Shearer. Join us for the next Fresh Air.